And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Michelle Stacy to the program today. Michelle is a journalist, editor, and writer of nonfiction, frequently looking at nutrition and health. Among her previous books are Consumed, Why Americans Love, Hate, and Fear Food, and The Fasting Girl, A True Victorian Medical Mystery. Today, we'll be discussing her latest, Holiday Keto, which is published by Centennial Books. Michelle, Holiday Keto is more than just a recipe book. You take the reader through a lot of aspects of a ketogenic diet, and you do start off with the basics.
Yes, I think it's really important for people to understand what the underpinnings are, because as you know, there's a million fad diets out there, and this one has an increasing amount of science and studies behind it. And it's good to understand why this actually works for people.
It's a diet that has quite some history behind it because it did not start off as a weight loss diet.
Exactly. In fact, they first started recognizing some benefits to ketones, which are the alternate fuel that your body makes on a keto diet. Researchers first discovered some benefits to that about 100 years ago. And oddly enough, it was when studying children who had epilepsy that wasn't responding to any other therapies. And they would have the kids fast for a period of time. And just like being on a keto diet, fasting makes your body, you don't have any glucose to use as fuel, so your body has to start making ketones. And they realized that it really was the ketones that were kind of calming the inflammation in the brain that was causing the epilepsy. It affects your entire system, your brain, your heart, your pancreas, because that's where your insulin comes from, your liver. It's a systemic kind of thing. And then, you know, once people realize that it's actually for many people a fairly easy way to lose weight, then of course, you know, that's when it became super popular, because that's what everybody wants to do, right?
Inflammation is one of those key words that we hear a lot in health circles recently. So how is sugar and insulin and glucose, all that tied in with inflammation in the human body?
Well, inflammation, I mean, just the basics on inflammation are that it's a response to a threat in our body. And it's a response of our immune system. And if we didn't have that response, we would die from bacteria, from a cut, or wouldn't be able to fight off the flu. But what happens with our standard American diet now is that many people have an inflammatory response going on in their body all the time. And in fact, there was a big global study that came out sometime in the last year that estimated that a huge number, the majority of deaths from all kinds of different chronic diseases really boil down to inflammation, whether you're talking heart disease, dementia, cancer. So the way it ties into keto and the basis of keto is essentially that you eat a lot more fat and almost no carbs and a sort of moderate amount of protein. And what happens when you eat sugar or even refined carbs like flour, a bagel or a piece of cake or something, sugar itself, we now know, is inflammatory. It causes this reaction in your body where you start releasing more of these inflammatory, they're called cytokines, these molecules, and you start releasing more of them than you really need. They then turn around and start damaging your body, especially damaging the inside of your blood vessels. And fat simply does not do that. Sugar is highly inflammatory.
And we've been hearing a lot about cytokines recently with COVID-19, the cytokine storm where it starts attacking the body.
Right. And they're still trying to draw all those lines and figure out why exactly it does that. But one of the first things they started realizing about COVID-19 was that people weren't necessarily dying from, say, the virus itself. Their body, their lungs were being attacked by our own immune cells. You know, they're still trying to pick apart why exactly the coronavirus prompts that. But inflammation is one of those things. It's a double-edged sword. It's, as I said, you couldn't live without it. It's why when you get a cut, you can see that all around the cut is kind of red and inflamed. And then a few days later, you've literally made new skin. And that's all due to inflammation. But when it's out of control, it really damages the body.
A ketogenic diet is a form of a low-carb diet, but it's different from Atkins and it's different from paleo. What are the key differentiation between keto and those other diets?
They are quite similar. But Atkins, for instance, it is low carb, but I would say two differences. Atkins places more emphasis on protein. Fat is fine, but fat isn't the number one nutrient. And in keto, it really is. I mean, a true keto diet is about 75% fat of your calories are coming from fat and only about 20% from protein and very few from carbs. And the other distinction is that while Atkins is low carb, it's not as low carb as keto. Nothing is as low carb as keto. So I think when you're on Atkins, there are several different stages. And the first stage is the closest to a keto diet because it's extremely low carb. But that only lasts a few weeks on Atkins. And then you start adding in a few more carbs, healthy carbs, like legumes, you know, lentils, and maybe a sweet potato now and then. And then as far as keto and paleo, the basis of paleo is getting back to how humans used to eat long before we had agriculture and we had flour processing mills and even before we were growing crops. So while paleo tends to be lower carb than just the average diet, it really just focuses on those foods that early man might have, you know, scavenged for, hunted for, foraged for. So, for instance, you can eat any kind of fruits on a paleo diet, because early man, if there was fruit there, they were certainly going to eat that. It's a great food. Most fruits are too high in carbs to be on keto. So on paleo, you can eat fruits. You don't eat grains at all because they're a product of agriculture. And interestingly, paleo also does not include any dairy because they consider that also, you know, part of our agricultural system. And keto loves dairy. Keto loves, you know, butter and cream and all that just for its fat content.
Yeah, counterintuitively, a full fat milk is better for you on keto than something like a skim milk.
Absolutely. Because for one thing, I think the thing that's so hard for people to, when they first start thinking about keto, to sort of get their head around is that fat is good. Like, we're so used to seeing non-fat yogurt, skim milk, reduced fat this, reduced fat that. And many people now feel that one reason that obesity is just off the charts in this country in the last 20 to 30 years, and type 2 diabetes is skyrocketing as well. And a lot of people draw some lines from the nutritional guidelines that the government was putting out in the late 70s, early 80s, where they said, they remember the pyramid? Mm-hmm. The whole bottom of the pyramid was essentially whole grains. And then they put fats way up at the top, like limit them, you know? And that was based on research that had been around for a long time and that was just not very accurate. It was research that was based on looking at entire populations and what they ate and what their disease rates were. And that's a highly speculative way to look at outcomes because it can show associations, but it cannot show cause and effect. It's like we're having to sort of readjust our thinking and take those grains off the bottom of the pyramid, because it's one thing if you eat, you know, brown rice or something. But if you eat grains the way most people eat grains, you're eating breakfast cereal, you're eating breads, you're eating bagels or donuts and pastries and Cinnabon and all that stuff. Those have greatly contributed to the health problems that we have in this country.
what exactly is going on in the body when you reach a state of ketosis?
Well, what happens is the most important substance in this whole thing is insulin, which is a hormone. And just like inflammation, it's an extremely important part of how our body survives and processes food, but it can have a dark side. First, I'll say what happens on a standard diet, like say you eat a bowl of Special K or a bagel. Those foods are mostly carbohydrate, and so which quickly is turned into broken down into glucose in your body. And almost instantaneously, it happens when you're still chewing. And then, you know, so your blood suddenly gets this big rush of glucose, but it can't get from your bloodstream into the rest of your body, like into your muscles, without insulin. So when you get all this sugar in your blood, your pancreas releases a dose of insulin. And it's like it's been described as kind of a key that opens the door to taking the sugar out of your blood and putting it into your body. So that's great. You get the energy from that. But when you eat largely carbohydrates, the other thing about insulin is that it's known as a fat storing hormone. So a bunch of this glucose goes into your body. The insulin opens the door, goes into your body, and your body can't use all of it, this whole load of it at once. And so insulin takes what's left over and puts it into fat storage. And then you feel hungry again too. That's that kind of roller coaster hunger thing that people have where they eat something really carby and then a couple hours later they're hungry again because that insulin did its job so well. And one reason that we're seeing such a rise in type 2 diabetes is that if you eat that way a lot over a long period of time, your pancreas essentially kind of wears out. It's making so much insulin all the time, pumping it out. And at the same time, your body is becoming resistant to the insulin. It's almost like a drug tolerance where you keep needing more to get the same effect. So it throws that whole beautiful system out of whack. Now, if you take all those carbs away or almost all of them away and you eat, say, a piece of steak and a side of spinach sauteed in olive oil, those foods, first of all, break down much more slowly than a simple carb. So there's not this big rush into your bloodstream that the insulin needs to come deal with. And those foods simply do not raise your insulin very high. And if you go a period of time where you're just not giving your body many carbs to process, when your insulin is low, your fat stores can open up essentially because insulin isn't tucking things away in there. It's letting your fat stores be accessed. So what people find is that what the goal in keto is to basically be fueling your body with fat instead of fueling it with carbs. And you're fueling it both with the fat that you're taking in, but ultimately also from your body fat, which is why many, many people lose weight on keto.
And it seems that with keeping insulin down in the bloodstream, another popular way of eating nowadays, intermittent fasting, would be helpful mm-hmm. with that too. Do keto mm-hmm. and intermittent fasting, could you do those two together?
They actually, I've written various articles about that relationship because they are a great pair. They actually work incredibly well together. Because for one thing, fasting, just as I mentioned with the kids with epilepsy, fasting, because your body is not getting any carbs to run on because it's getting nothing to run on, that can promote your liver to start making ketones. So fasting itself can be a ketogenic way of living. So it's kind of like they synergistic. They're both working, both diets are working towards the same goal. But the other thing that makes them go so well together is that a keto diet tends to be very satiating because, as I said, fat breaks down slowly and fuels you for a longer period of time. So if you're both eating keto and then, say, doing an intermittent fasting regimen where that I think the most popular form is you only eat during an 8-hour window every day. So for many people, what they do is they get up and they don't have anything but, say, black coffee or tea until noon. And they eat at noon and then they finish eating by 8 p.m. at night. And it's just simply much easier to fast for a period of time if when you do eat, what you're eating are a lot of fats.
In the past, I've tried alternate day fasting. And when people talk about, oh, I haven't eaten, I feel weak, I did not feel that way at all. I had like this hyper awareness because I think my body was going, hey, you need some food, pay attention. And I mean, there's a strange amount of clarity that comes from getting into that ketosis state.
You know, it's so interesting that you've experienced that because that is extremely common. I have tried alternate day fasting. I'm terrible at it because I get very grumpy. So I do more of the 16-8, but that is a very, very common reaction. And the way researchers have explained that to me is that it's basically a survival mechanism that we've had, you know, as part of our DNA kind of forever. Because when you think about it, when you think about early man and how insecure the food environment was, you know, there might be a drought and there was very little food. You might have trouble, you know, killing animals to eat. There were seasonal changes that might really change your, you know, what foods you could get a hold of. And so it's hypothesized that early man just intermittent fasted all the time. You know, when they could eat, they ate, and when they couldn't, they had to keep going. And if our bodies were made so that after not eating for a day, we just kind of collapsed in a heap, our species would not have survived. And so we have all these mechanisms that kick in after a while with fasting. And it makes total sense that some of that would be brain clarity. Because as you said, you have to be, you know, our ancient DNA says you better get active here about finding some food, you know. So really, it's a documented thing that it works that way. And in fact, that's why intermittent fasting and keto both are very popular with the whole like Silicon Valley set, because they're all about how do I hack my brain, you know, biohack my system to work even better. And they all talk about that brain boost.
It's a cliche, but it's very appropriate for keto. If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. You have to have yes. a plan when you're on keto.
Yes, especially because of the world in which we live. Because all of the food options that you see around you, like one of the hardest things to do on keto is snacking, because our entire snack universe is carb based. You know, it's pretzels, it's potato chips, it's corn nuts, it's those grab and go kind of things. And many of these things are very, very tempting. I mean, you walk past at least here on the East Coast, you know, pizza by the slice is everywhere. So if you go out hungry and you need to snack and you don't have, say, a bag of nuts in your purse, you know, that's a great snack, or on keto, or those little baby Bon Bel cheese things are another popular item. But especially what came into play when I was working on the holiday keto book is that, you know, the holiday season, I mean, this year it's a little different, but in general, it's about a lot of parties and a lot of noshing and a lot of drinking. And if you go to somebody's cocktail party, you're going to be confronted with cheese and crackers and, you know, just all these delicious and non-keto foods. So one piece of advice that I give people a lot is, you know, be a generous guest. Bring your own keto appetizers, and they're so delicious that people won't even know that, oh, that's actually on the keto diet. But you absolutely have to plan, because impulse eating is going to be carb eating, honestly.
this year, especially with COVID-19, we're not socializing, we're staying home. This gives people an opportunity to try new things, new dishes at much lower stakes. They don't have to worry about impressing anybody. They can try out new things and see mm-hmm. what really works for them and what would be good for a social setting.
You know, one thing that's important to emphasize about keto, because there are unhealthy ways to do keto. I mean, there's something called dirty keto. And what that means is not as good as a dirty martini. That means eating foods that are technically keto, but really are not health foods, like, you know, pork rinds or just tons of bacon and, you know, junk food, but without the bun on it and that kind of thing. And a healthy keto diet really does involve a lot of cooking, because a lot of the ready-made foods that you get in this country, even those at the grocery store that label themselves healthy, are really, they have a lot of things in them that aren't on the keto diet and aren't really very good for you. You know, especially if you're looking at any kind of packaged food, really, things that come in boxes or freezer packs, those are one reason they can sit on the shelf for so long, is that they have various things in them that don't behave very well in your body and fats that are not, you know, not good for your body. Because there are fats that are not good for your body. Not every fat is good on keto. It's the cold pressed fats like olive oil, coconut oil, avocado oil, walnut oil. But some of the fats that have been marketed as healthy, like vegetable oil or canola oil, are actually highly refined. And that's a process that can actually make them somewhat toxic. So, you know, those are not great. So the way that you control for all of this is really by cooking and finding, you know, fun keto recipes, which even include desserts, because there are non-carb sweeteners you can use, and you can use almond flour, coconut flour in place of wheat flour, and make things that, you know, they're just wonderful treats.
Like the old maxim, when you go to the grocery store, stay on the outside. You go through produce, meat, and dairy, and you should be good.
Exactly. If everything in your cart is essentially a whole food, you know, it's a sweet potato or a piece of meat, a piece of chicken, milk, eggs, you really can't go wrong with those if you stay away from the processed foods.
While you do have recipes for alcoholic drinks, there are sweeteners called sugar alcohols that aren't intended to intoxicate.
Yes. And there's really a whole new universe of sweeteners now made from things like monk fruit. And they have a high level of sweetness and what's without the carbs, and simply because they behave differently in your body than carbs do. And what's great about some of these products too is that, you know, it used to be that the only things, sweeteners that we had, first of all, had that kind of tinny taste to them, and also just weren't of the same bulk as sugar. You know, you couldn't have a cup of Splenda and have that equal a cup of sugar in a recipe. But these new sweeteners, you can absolutely swap them in as if they were sugar.
Now, some do impact blood sugar in different ways, so you have to be really careful and do some research on which one might be most appropriate for yourself.
Yes, and there are basically, you can get a lot of, I mean, you can find some of these in stores, but a lot of these products you can find through online retailers and their products like erythritol. And some of these, you know, if you really want to make sure that you're staying on a keto diet, some of these are marketed through various keto blogs and keto websites. Because one thing you can say about keto is it is all over the internet. You can get so much information, and a lot of it is pretty good, you know, and a lot of these websites like dietdoctor.com, everything that they talk about has a study attached to it, you know, so it's really research based.
When I was looking at some of the recipes, I saw one for your take on a traditional caprese salad. with tomatoes and mozzarella. And I went, does that really seem, that seems like a summer dish, not really holiday. But then I thought the red of the tomatoes and the white of the mozzarella. Hey, that's a perfect Christmas color combination.
Why not? Well, the funny thing is too, these days, I mean, you know, I may complain about the food environment that we live in that's so kind of overstuffed. But one really good side to where we are now with food in this country in general is that foods are available because of our food transport systems. You know, it used to be back in the day that you really only ate asparagus in February and March. And, you know, if you're fine with eating asparagus from South America or Mexico, it's in the grocery store all the time. And so are tomatoes, although some of them aren't so wonderful in the winter. I think the grape tomatoes are better. The small ones are much better. But yeah, we've kind of become a pan-seasonal food climate.
With all the talk recently of locally sourced and seasonally appropriate, I mean, this time of year is really heavy on root vegetables, and that's not very good for keto.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, where while I see the thinking behind the locavore movement, and I love that where I live in the Hudson Valley of New York, for instance, we get such a great variety of apples in the fall, you know, and we're lucky because there are a lot of apple orchards in New York State. But if you only eat that way, your diet's really going to be limited, you know. I mean, yeah, you'll be okay. But so what I would say to people is prioritize local when you can, you know, but to try to do that all the time is really pretty challenging nutritionally.
Well, we don't want to give away the entire book, but could you share us one quick drink recipe that people could get a taste for what you're doing here in the book?
One point that we make about drinks is that some of them are just naturally keto no matter what. You know, a martini has, the gin or vodka martini has zero carbs. But, you know, one thing that I think is really nice is a hot buttered rum. Mm. I think that's just a wonderful, cozy winter holiday recipe. And it's because it's got butter in it, you know, it's almost like a festive version of bulletproof coffee. Exactly. You know, so it's got cinnamon and nutmeg and dark rum and butter and just a tiny bit of a monk fruit sweetener. And, you know, you just warm that up. Well, you warm up everything except the rum. You put the rum in at the last minute, because if you cook the rum, it's not going to have much alcohol left in it.
Well, Michelle, I want to thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us today and encouraging us to think more about our health and to eat better, even at this time of year when it seems to be so difficult to do so.
That's my pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much, and take care and happy holidays.
Thanks. Same to you.
Michelle Stacy is the author of Holiday Keto, which is published by Centennial Books. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk. And happy holidays to one and all.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.